May it please the court, my name is Liz Porter-Merrill. My attorney registration number is 38447, and I'm here today to represent the defendant appellant, Mr. Robert Turner. There are two issues on appeal, the legality of the police stopping Mr. Turner, and whether the prosecution presented sufficient evidence on the possession of burglary tools conviction. My argument today will begin with the first issue, whether the police conducted an investigatory stop without reasonable suspicion, thereby violating Mr. Turner's Fourth Amendment rights. If there's time, I'll address this second issue. Among other rights, the Fourth Amendment protects the right of every person to enjoy the use of public streets without unwarranted interference or harassment by law enforcement officers. The U.S. and Colorado constitutions prohibit unreasonable searches and seizures. If the police do not obtain a warrant from a judge, searches and seizures are presumptively unreasonable. Here, in short, two police officers stopped Mr. Turner as he was walking down a public street at 10:30 p.m. on New Year's Eve. The two officers stopped their marked patrol car, got out of their car, approached Mr. Turner, were wearing uniforms and displaying their guns, and altered Mr. Turner's movement.
They didn't display the guns in the sense they drew them out of the car.
Correct.
They were wearing guns like any other police officer does.
Absolutely. The officers asked him, Mr. Turner, to do something more. They asked him to take off his backpack, which contained his belongings. The police seized Mr. Turner no later than when the police caused him to take off his backpack.
Counsel, I believe in the briefs there's some reference to the fact that at trial, it came out that the officers had in fact helped him remove his backpack. Do you know whether the motion to suppress was renewed in light of that additional fact?
I do not believe the motion to suppress was renewed at the trial, but I included that in the opening brief and footnotes to give the court an idea of what the entire evidence at trial was for appellate purposes.
Recognizing that we generally can't consider that when we're looking at the suppression order.
Correct. Well, Moody says that for defendant standing, you can't use the defendant's trial testimony to find that there's no defense standing to challenge the suppression search. And generally, I think there's room to argue that perhaps Moody has a limited holding, but for the sake of this argument, we can assume that we're only going to look at the suppression evidence, and even just on the suppression evidence, there was not reasonable suspicion to stop Mr. Turner.
At the suppression hearing, mm-hmm. did the officer articulate a safety reason for asking that the backpack be removed?
Officer Hackett said that Officer Sandoval asked Mr. Turner to take off his backpack for officer safety reasons. He clarified later in his testimony that he didn't actually ask Officer Sandoval didn't actually say for officer safety reasons. It was just assumed, it was speculation on Officer Hackett's part that was why Officer Sandoval was asking Mr. Turner to remove his backpack. There was no suggestion in the Officer Hackett's suppression hearing testimony that they were actually concerned for officer safety. And there was no evidence to support that they were concerned for officer safety.
Thank you.
So like I was saying, the police seized Mr. Turner no later than when they caused him to remove his backpack. The district court recognized that this was the point, this was the pivot point for the case. And the court acknowledged that although there was a long line of cases to support that this was the beginning of a detention, the court then relied on a case that the Colorado Supreme Court announced that very day, People versus Funes Pacla, to conclude that the facts were similar to that case in which the Supreme Court reversed a trial court suppression ruling. But the court erred because, one, the police did not have reasonable suspicion. They did not satisfy at least two of the three prongs of the reasonable suspicion test. And second, the facts of this case are actually more analogous to a different Colorado Supreme Court case that was issued about a couple months earlier, People versus Revel. And that decision, like I said, came out a couple months before in February. This was happening in May. And the trial court did not consider People versus Revel when it was analyzing the suppression issue, even though that was the defense counsel's case that it relied upon.
Let me ask you to back up a second.
Mm-hmm.
The facts, as I understand them, indicate, and you kind of skipped this, that when the officers approached Mr. Turner, the first thing they said something like this, hey, what's going on?
Correct.
And he said, or where are you going? And he said, I'm just going home. Which, do you agree that that was, and I think the court found, that was just a consensual encounter?
I would not necessarily concede that that was a consensual encounter. I don't. I think that clearly the seizure occurred when they asked him to remove his bag. But going back to that point in time, because Mr. Turner was walking one direction down the street and then switched direction under Terry and other cases, if you alter the movement of the defendant, the police officers force the defendant or the person suspect to alter their course of movement, then that is part of the analysis in determining whether a seizure has occurred.
Did they all cause him to alter his direction, or did he do it voluntarily when he saw the police?
Well, that is the same thing under the case law.
Under the case law, in the case I think you're thinking about, the police actually pulled up in front of the defendant, kind of blocked his path with the police car, and then he went the other direction, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
A little different than this situation here.
Okay. That's fine. You don't need to necessarily find that the seizure occurred at that moment. In response to the officer saying, hey man, where are you going? Mr. Turner said, just going home, which at that point completely dispelled any purpose for the stop, which is the second prong of the reasonable suspicion test. So the first prong being that the police officers have to have reasonable suspicion that the individual had committed or was about to commit a crime, which they didn't have that here. And then the second prong of that is that the purpose of the stop must be reasonable. So the officer testified at the suppression hearing that the reason he stopped Mr. Turner was because there was no reason for Mr. Turner to be in that neighborhood at that time.
And the way he was dressed, and the fact that he seemed to hide his face, and the fact that he was wearing dark clothing.
Well, I'm distinguishing those as the reasons for the stop itself, I understand what you're saying.
Yes, there's a very instantaneous
moment. The purpose
moment.
Is what I was focusing on.
There's an instantaneous moment in time when it somehow may have become a stop, when he asked him to take his backpack off. What happened in that instantaneous moment of time that was different from before?
Okay, so...
Nothing.
No. So he submitted to the show of police authority, and that is clear on the PADAR ED, is the point in which a seizure occurs. Either the police actually physically contact the defendant, or the police exercise a show of authority and the defendant submits. So here, the officers asked him to remove his bag, which is his possessions, mm-hmm. and he submits to that show of authority. That shows that he was seized at that point in time.
Not for very long, though. He took off.
It doesn't matter. It stops at that point in time. That anything that happens after that is irrelevant to the analysis.
But one of the hallmarks of those Terry stop is the suspect's not free to leave.
Yes.
Or doesn't feel he's free to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Mr. Turner felt he was free to leave.
Well, you can't. It's very clear under suppression case law. You stop the analysis at the point that the seizure occurred, and the seizure occurred before he fled.
And
so you cannot consider his flight as part of the seizure.
And so it occurred when they said, would you please take off, would you take off your backpack?
I don't think they said, please.
Whatever they said. I retract that part of it.
Yeah. Mr. Sandoval did not testify at the suppression hearing. The prosecution had the burden of proving that this was constitutional, and they did not present his testimony, and that was the pivot point in the trial court's mind as to whether a seizure occurred, as how that bag came off of Mr. Turner.
Well, let's assume that a seizure within the meaning of Terry occurred when the officer said, take off your backpack.
Okay.
All right. At that time, it was known to the officers that the man was dressed in dark clothing.
Mm-hmm.
It was late at night. He was in front of a closed business. There was nobody else on the street. And why aren't those facts collectively sufficient for a Terry stop?
Okay. So first off, it was 10:30 at night on New Year's Eve, a night when most people are out pretty late.
But there's no restaurants or bars or anything in the neighborhood?
No, right? He was walking through a neighborhood and approaching an intersection in which there were lots of businesses along Morrison Road.
But we're not talking about restaurants and bars. These are all closed.
No, no.
These are closed businesses that nobody has any reason to be around at 10:30 at night. Fair?
Unless you're walking down the street, a public byway, which is what he was doing. So he was not just standing in front of a closed business, loitering or anything like that. He was actually walking. He was moving. This is where it's really important to analogize this case to other cases. Reval, it was actually 11:30 at night. The defendant in that case was standing outside a closed business, looking left to right. Then he crossed the street and walked to an open liquor store, continued looking left to right, and then walked around the building to the backside that was dark. I would submit to this court that Mr. Turner's actions were far less suspicious than the defendant in Reval. And yet nevertheless, the Supreme Court said that was, the police did not have reasonable suspicion. And he walked away too when he saw the police.
And then very shortly after that, in the next case, Funes, however it's pronounced, they distinguish Reval because they say, well, in Reval, there were other businesses open and other people out and about. Whereas in Funes, it was closed businesses, 1:15 in the morning. I mean, it's a pretty fine line.
It absolutely
but obviously
is.
We have to see on which side of that line this case falls.
Absolutely.
So doesn't it matter here that there weren't a lot of other people out and about?
So Reval, so the Colorado Supreme Court recognized these are very similar. And in fact, in the dissent in Funes Agua, they're talking about how that, and it's true, if you look at Reval, the holding in Reval is not based upon the businesses being opened or closed and not based upon people being around. They do talk about that. But the holding of the case is based on the facts that I just presented to this court.
That's in the opinion of the dissenters in Funes.
Well, if you look at the opinion in Reval, they do not discuss, they do not quote Terry for the proposition about open, closed businesses and people being around until the end, after they have concluded that there was no reasonable suspicion. So that's essentially dicta and citing case law of the Supreme Court. But you're right, it's absolutely a fine line. The problem is in Funes Pacua, he was standing, he was actually loitering outside the business. The police heard a loud bang of something falling, and then they saw him actually run away. He wasn't walking. And the case law actually is really good about distinguishing between walking away from the police and running away from the police. For our own sake, be like, that is a very fine distinction. But the case law does draw a distinction between walking away from the police and running away from the police. And so in Funes Pacua, I think that the added suspicion comes from the fact that there was a loud noise inside the business, and then he was running away, and then they stopped him. I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
May I please the court? My name is Victoria Cisneros, registration number 45519, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. The key issue in this case is when the defendant was actually seized. It's the people's position that when the police first encountered the defendant, it was actually a consensual stop. It was 10:30 at night. They saw him on New Year's Eve walking down the street. As they passed him, they saw him turn and go the other direction. They contacted him, stopped the car. There was no activation of overhead sirens or lights, no display of service weapons, a calm tone of voice, two officers. The first officer gets out of the car and says, "Hey, what's going on?" He says, "I'm just walking home." The second officer gets out of the car and says, "Can you go ahead and put your bag down for me?" The defendant drops his bag and takes off running.
Okay, let's stop you right there. Can you take your bag off, an assertion of police authority?
Not necessarily. Officers are allowed to make reasonable requests to ensure a safe encounter, and that's exactly what they did.
Okay, was there any testimony of a person with direct knowledge as to why the order was given to put the backpack on the ground?
On page 8 of the suppression hearing, Officer Hackett testified that he understood Officer Sandoval's request to put the bag down for officer safety because there were various tools and handles hanging out.
Okay, but he didn't give the order.
He did not give the order.
The two of them didn't talk about what the other gentleman, Sanchez?
Sandoval.
Sandoval. There's no prior discussion between the two as to what Sandoval's motive is.
There is not.
So how is Hackett a competent witness to testify as to Sandoval's motive in giving the order?
He was also there present. He also saw the bag on the defendant's back and saw the handles hanging out. And he goes on to say, we didn't know if there was a bat, if there were knives. We just didn't know what he had in that bag.
But he didn't give the order.
No, he didn't give the order, but I don't think in this short amount of time that they had the opportunity to have that discussion about whether there was something to be, whether they needed to discuss that. They both saw the handle sticking out of the bag.
But the prosecutor could have called Mr. Sandoval to say, why did you have him put the backpack on the ground? The prosecutor made the decision not to do that.
The prosecutor made the decision not to do that. I don't have any indication in the record as to why the prosecutor made that decision. But what Officer Hackett testified to was that they asked him to put the bag down because they were concerned about officer safety based on the handles that were sticking out of the bag.
And is it the officer safety dimension that precludes the order to put the backpack on the ground from converting a consensual encounter into a Terry stop?
I believe it is, Your Honor. As in People v. Shepherd, the court stated that officers are allowed to give reasonable requests to ensure a safe encounter without transforming that consensual encounter into an investigatory stop.
So the pivot point is officer safety?
I believe in this case it is. I believe okay, that was...
Is that determined objectively looking at the facts as described, or is it determined subjectively based upon the intent of the officer giving the command?
I believe it would be an objective test, and I think in this case, because we have the handles sticking out of the bags, which the officers did not know what those were at the time that they asked the defendant to put the bag down, that is enough for the officers to be concerned about their safety in contacting this person in an area where there is no one else around, late at night, and he's taken some furtive gesture, as it was, to make sure that they're not putting themselves at risk in any way.
Thank you.
Again, there's no indication in the record that they attempted to impede the defendant's path. Obviously, he fled from them, but they did not block him. They did not force him to alter his course of direction. He voluntarily took that action once he saw them.
And could we move on to that step next? Let's forget for a moment whether it's still consensual when the bag gets put down. Once he starts taking off and they chase after him, you would agree that it's no longer a consensual encounter, right?
I don't know if I would agree with that necessarily, Your Honor. I think at that point, when he takes off, because it had been a consensual encounter up until that point, and when he takes off, they have reasonable suspicion to chase him. And
just because he's taking off.
In addition to everything else, in addition to his location, 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night, on New Year's Eve, so in an area where there are only closed businesses, there's no indication in the record that there were any open businesses near this area. And this is an evening where these businesses would definitely be deserted. And when the officers see him, and they see him take a furtive action by turning and walking in a different direction from them, it's at that point when they're on routine patrol, it is their job to investigate suspicious behavior and possible criminal activity. When he takes off, that adds to their reasonable suspicion. I would submit that the seizure does not actually happen until he is tackled following the foot chase.
Okay.
But at that point, when they chase him, they do have reasonable suspicion to continue chasing him. And the bag, I would argue, is abandoned at that point when he drops it and runs, very much like Hodari. He dropped the bag, took off running, and the officers had to chase him down and physically tackle him in order to subdue him.
Well, in Hodari, Was he ordered to drop the bag, or did he just take one look at the police and throw it and start running?
He took one look at the police and threw it, took off running.
Okay.
Here, I don't believe that the request to drop the bag changes the analysis that much. Requesting him to put down the bag, he could have put down the bag, they could have had a quick chat. Ultimately, he probably would have been arrested because he did have an active warrant out once they had his name. But we actually don't know what would have happened at that point. Had he put down the bag and said to the officer, no, I'm just going home, I'm a few blocks from here, they might have said okay and let him continue on his way.
We also don't know what would have happened if they hadn't told him to put the bag on the ground.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. We don't know what would have happened if they hadn't told him to put down the bag. The duration of this encounter was so short. It was a matter, I would submit, a minute or two between the time they stopped him, got out of the car and said, hey, what's going on? And he takes off running.
And you would agree with me with the basic principle that people do have a right to not talk to the police. Policeman comes up to me, I say, I don't want to talk to you, I walk away. So we need more than just he takes off. So what I hear you saying, I think, is that he takes off, plus it's 11:30 at night, plus he's wearing dark clothing, plus businesses are closed. We need all that packaged together.
In order to get to reasonable suspicion,
okay,
to call it an investigatory stop. But I would submit that in the beginning, it is a consensual encounter. And there is no show of authority. We don't have any of the factors present that the court generally looks at to determine if it's been a detention or a consensual encounter. There was no activation of the sirens. There was no retention of identification. They hadn't even asked him his name at that point. There was no block of his egress. Any of those things, no display of weapon. None of those things were present. This is much more like Shepherd. In Shepherd, the defendant was stopped after the police officer received the call. He asks him to put his bag down, and then they go on to do a search during which they find drugs and ultimately arrest him. But the court found that that was a consensual encounter in that case.
And that's your position in this case. This was a consensual encounter, at least until he took off.
Yes, Your Honor. And at the very least, until he took off, this was a consensual encounter.
Although counsel for the appellant didn't get there, I want to ask you some questions about the sufficiency of the evidence argument. All these things you just articulated and Judge Webb articulated add up to reasonable suspicion to believe a crime was committed. I guess you don't have to tell us what crime they believe was committed, that the reasonable suspicion led up to, but he was convicted of possession of burglary tools, and he had to have the intent to use those burglary tools to commit, I guess, a burglary.
Yes.
What else was there? There was evidence that you say adds up to reasonable suspicion. By the time you get to trial, what else was there?
At trial,
the conviction of guilt.
At trial, the jury heard all of these things. Mm-hmm. They also heard that when they opened the bag, there were bolt cutters, pipe cutters, and the officers testified that these were all tools that could be used to burglarize a building, that could be used to break a window.
They could also be tools that people have in their garage, so
yes,
that's not enough by itself.
The officers also gave testimony that inside the bag of tools, there was also a second bag, which they testified could be used to take, to put any items that the defendant stole into the second bag to carry it all away. These were the facts that the jury was presented with at trial. Evidence of intent is rarely proven by direct evidence. Here it was all circumstantial evidence, which the jury heard and chose to infer that the defendant had the intent to commit a crime.
Was there also evidence at trial that when they confronted him, he ran away, he fled?
Yes, there was also evidence presented at trial that he fled.
So can the jury take that into account, his consciousness of guilt?
I believe the jury could take that into account.
Was that argued by the prosecutor?
I believe it was, I'm not sure, Your Honor, I believe it was argued maybe during the closing argument that that was evidence of his guilt. Ultimately, the jury is the fact finder, and it is their job to resolve any inconsistencies and weigh the credibility of the officers and the testimony and the evidence that's presented before them. They did that, and they chose to find that the defendant had the intent to commit a crime, specifically probably burglary, and find him guilty of that offense. This court is not here to sit as a 13th juror, and as such, it should affirm the jury's finding and the defendant's convictions.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I would respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's convictions.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Merrill?
I just would like to respond to a couple of the points my the Attorney General made during the argument. First, Schaeffer is a court of appeals decision. This court is free to disagree with other divisions of the Court of Appeals, but I'd like to focus on the fact that there was no testimony in this case that the officers were actually fearful for their safety.
Does Schaeffer address the subjective objective inquiry? In other words, the officers could describe the circumstances. And a judge, if it's an objective test, then a judge could say, well, there was some safety concerns. Or it's a subjective test, and the officer who gave the order would have to say, yeah, that's why I did it. So which is it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I apologize. Okay. I don't remember offhand what Schaeffer says, if it addresses this point at all. But my intuition is that if officers can always say that they need to look inside a bag or have a bag removed for officer safety purposes, then we're the exception is going to swallow the rule in this essence, because then you have no privacy in your personal belongings anymore. It sounded like the Attorney General was suggesting that there were furtive gestures, and I do not recall there being any evidence at the suppression hearing or otherwise that Mr. Turner made any furtive gestures.
He turned his face to the wall or something like that, I think was it. No?
I don't believe
so. They argue on their brief, but maybe it's not in the hearing. Okay.
I mean, I read the suppression hearing testimony yesterday, but I don't remember, but you could be absolutely correct. It also appears that the Attorney General is using fled or flight to describe both walking away and running away, and I think, as we talked about before, and has already been finally, the distinction under U.S. Supreme case law in Hadari D is whether or not the defendant submitted to the show of authority. So Mr. Turner relinquishing his bag is absolutely not something trivial here. I see that my time is up. I ask that this court reverse the trial court suppression ruling and remand for a new trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your fine arguments. The case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course. And again, I want to